again, everybody. It's time for the Mainland Podcast. It is episode number 60. I am Michael Citro, and I am the managing editor for themainland.com. Welcome to our program. I am joined this week once again by senior columnist Andrew Harrison. Andrew, how are you this evening?
I am riding high off a win, so it's always a good... what day is it today? Thursday.
Yeah, we're recording this on Thursday. Yeah. We were going to record it on Tuesday and have it done early in the week, and I wasn't feeling well, so we put it off, and now everything's back to normal
here. I'm still riding high, though.
It's been a long time. That's good. Of course, it was Jason Kreis's debut as Orlando City coach in MLS, it should be mentioned. And, you know, it seemed like things were kind of going to go the way that they have been going in terms of the team. You know, pretty much played, I thought, better than New England in the first half. But all they had to show for it was a crazy deflection that ended up in a Kai Kamara breakaway goal and a 1-0 Revolution lead at the end of the first half. How did you see that first half?
I saw it as a continuation of the Heath era. We were prone to mistakes. We didn't look like we were up for the game. And I think we were, you know, as you mentioned, we just got punished for that mistake that we made. I don't think it was a great first half, though, and it's definitely not one for the history books, unlike the second half, which went a lot better for the Orlando City side.
It did. You know, I remember I was at the game, obviously. I was covering the game in the press box, and I remember looking at the stat sheet, and I thought, man, you know, Orlando City is leading every category except the one that matters, which is on the scoreboard. They were outpossessing New England. They had a more accurate passing. They were winning more duels, all of those things. And, you know, it was just really a bad bounce off of a deflection that ended up on a New England player instead of on an Orlando City player. But again, the Orlando City, they did have a few turnovers in the first half. And in the second half, they came out and Jason Kreis made a little bit of a tactical change at the half to get more players involved in the attack, and it worked. It worked like a charm because Orlando City came out and scored three unanswered, and they won going away 3-1, and just an absolutely marvelous performance from Kevin Molino.
Yeah, and I think what we really saw, for me personally, was a transition from the Heath system to the Kreis system. All of a sudden, he wasn't necessarily relying on the same players to play the same system. He went in and just made those adjustments that I think we had been much maligning coach Adrian Heath about over the years, not making the substitutions early enough, not showing the tactical changes that really needed to make a change to the game and the way it was going. We saw that this weekend. We got the results from it, and I think we saw some great performances. Kevin Molino was certainly capped off a great July, but Kakar played really well, and we started to see some glimpses of Antonio Nocerino as a potential player in this side, and Breck Shea looked revitalized now that the left-back experiment is eventually over.
Yeah, it was interesting. Jason Kreis came out with a lineup that surprised a lot of us. No Darwin Serén or, you know, Chris Nogueira in the starting defensive midfield. He went with Nocerino and Carrasco. He started Haji Berry at right wing. Mentioned after the game, he just played the players that he thought had the best weeks in training and earned it on the field, not only in the training pitch, but also in the midweek friendly last week in a 2-1 loss against Stoke City. I believe we recorded before the friendly last week. I don't think there's a whole lot to say about the friendly other than the team used it as a training exercise, and it kind of showed a little bit. But the promise is there. The second half, the first half was about not conceding, which they didn't. They got to halftime 0-0, and then the second half, a lot of the younger players came in, and the game opened up a little bit more and ended up in a 2-1 win for Stoke. But Haji Berry certainly was a star in that game, and that helped get him into the lineup against New England. What I saw in the first half of the Revolution game was Haji was doing a good job of getting forward, a good job using his speed, but in tight spaces he was not either not picking out the right pass or not able to execute on the right pass when he did pick it out. And that, I think, led in part to Breck Shea coming in the second half. And what I liked about Jason Kreis is that he wants his wingers to be able to cut inside and shoot on goal with their strong foot. So he left Molino on the left side. He mentioned also that Molino and Bowden play well defensively together as a pairing on that side, so he didn't want to break that up. And he said that, you know, he, obviously Breck Shea came in and he shot a few high ones, but, you know, I mean, not Rivas high, but he at least can't cut inside and did use his stronger left foot to bother the goalkeeper a little bit and to make New England's defense stay a little bit more honest. And I think that will pay huge dividends down the road if teams know that Molino and Shea will cut in and take shots. It might leave more space in the middle of the field for Lahren and Kaká to operate.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I think what we saw in the New England game is we saw the 5 years that Molino and Bowden have really had in that position. It was kind of abbreviated last year. Bowden didn't get a lot of starts. Molino was injured. But we really saw that chemistry that had been so successful in the lower leagues. We saw a resurgence of that. But what we also saw was the fact that all of a sudden Kaká was not being marked out of the game. We were being able to pull away New England's defensive midfield as well as their center backs, creating space. And I thought, you know, I've kind of been down on Breck Shea this season too. I thought it was one of his best halves of football this season in terms of penetration, in terms of actually not making that many mistakes because he didn't have to come back and also play the defensive role, which even after these 18 months that we've been doing this, he was still learning that job. It's not an easy job. It was a great performance all around. I think that Molino was well deserving of the Player of the Month nomination for MLS. I know he came third, but I think it's great to see that we're starting to get back into those nominations because we weren't playing good enough soccer to be recognized. And I love that Kreis has come in. It's only his second week now, his third week on the job, and we're already excited and energetic about this team again, even heading into a team like the Sounders on the weekend who are having their own struggles, but I'm still excited about that game.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Seattle a little bit more later, obviously, but Kevin Molino, 3 goals and 3 assists in the last 3 games, finished ahead of Giovinco in Player of the Month voting, so that's not nothing there. You know, finished behind Jake Gleason, and the winner was Lampard, for who's had an incredible month. So Kevin Molino was my man of the match. I don't know how you saw it, but I saw Kevin. You talked about Breck Shea. Breck Shea supplied the service on the game-winning goal with his weaker right foot with a very nice cross. And I thought that Molino played pretty well in the first half, but I thought it was going to be one of those things where, okay, as soon as he gets back to the right side where he feels more comfortable, he'll just turn it on. But in fact, he played pretty well in the first half, but in the second half, just really came alive when there was a, you know, I guess an equally fear-inspiring winger on the other side. I don't think that New England necessarily respected what Haji Berry did, and certainly he wasn't able to combine in the final third the way we would hope, but you know, not for lack of effort, certainly. But I thought that Shea definitely helped turn that game. Kaká played well, Molino played well, and I'm giving Molino my man of the match.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think you can't deny what he did in that game as being man of the match worthy. He turned it around. He did have a good, solid first half. But like you say, when really you're only really marking 3 out of the 4 players because New England isn't really giving credence to Haji Berry's attacking threat, and the kid was kind of all legs a little bit. Like, he was running, but he'd get tangled up, he'd lose it, he'd play himself into trouble so many times down towards the corner flag that he was getting a little... You could see why Kreis made the change. But I like the fact that he was able to play his way into the side. I think that's something we've really missed since being in MLS. And if we talk about having OCB as a development side, you have to give people the opportunity to play. Other than that, I think, like you say, Molino had a great second half because all of a sudden he was given the space because they had to mark Breck Shea out of the game as well. And they didn't mark either of them particularly well. So we combined to devastating effect and got that three, those desperate 3 points from a team that we're still chasing, but right behind.
Right. And even with them on points for the last playoff spot, they have the wins tiebreaker is the first tiebreaker. But the game in hand is certainly helpful because you get a draw or a win in that, and then you're ahead of them. So it's good to see. A win and two draws against the Revs this year, so they technically win the season series. And so that's always nice to get that first season series win over an Eastern Conference opponent. And, it was a good win because the Revs had been in fine form over the last three matches. They had they were unbeaten in three and had only allowed two goals in those three. And then, you go into the second half of that game thinking, oh, the Revs got it locked down. We're having possession but not getting a lot of dangerous chances. And then, boom, three goals in the second half. Although, it must be said, Kyle Larin had a golden opportunity early in the game and squibbed his shot wide, and then he had another chance with a shot that was deflected just inches wide in that first half. So, there still were some opportunities, just not as clear-cut as what we saw in the second half. But it'll be interesting to see if this was a momentary, sort of a elevation in play for the new coach, or if this is a reinvigorated side and a renewed with a renewed passion and lust for the game, and we'll find out a lot more about that on Sunday against Seattle.
Yeah, I think we talk about a new coach bounce. You could say it was probably that, but I think the fact is we didn't get the performance that we necessarily expected in the first half from a new coach bounce. I think you've got to put a lot on Christ, too, for making those tactical substitutions and understanding where the game wasn't working. Like we said, we had a pretty good first half. We were only down through a pretty solid, full-length field run by Kai Kamara to bury it. So he made that, and he made that subtle adjustment, and I think it was really interesting that he had also not started Higuita and Seren. He had made that adjustment to say that Carrasco and Nocerino were going to be the people to keep New England quiet. And let's be honest, they did that as well. We weren't. Mm-hmm. They never really looked like scoring, especially once we took control of the game. So I'm actually going to say that this is going to be a long-term development, hopefully, because he's not really changed it. He's not really added anybody. But we weren't relying on aging legs of Julio Baptista or something to make those changes. We were using the quality and the depth of this squad that we potentially have.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought was interesting was that he did bring in Seren and Higuita when it got to 3-1 to protect that lead. And that was, as it turned out, segue into our next topic, that was the last participation we'll see from Darwin Seren in a purple uniform for Orlando City, as he was traded just this week at the trade deadline to the San Jose Earthquakes for Matias Perez-Garcia, an attacking player, a short little guy, water bug, 5'5", who we've seen in a couple of matches against San Jose so far since Orlando City's joined MLS. A very dynamic player and a guy who looks like he can combine very well with the likes of Molino and Kaká. What do you think of this trade? How do you see this short term, and how do you maybe see it more longer term?
Let's take it short term. I think this is a good trade short term. I like Matias Perez-Garcia. I think he brings a lot to this side that really, when we do talk about depth, we don't have it. If Kaká goes down injured, we're then kind of relying on Baptista, on Molino to move inside and fill that gap. MPG can come in and kind of give us that break and maybe not force Kaká to play a full 90 minutes. Maybe that's what needs to start happening. We can't ignore the fact that Kaká is getting older. Long term, I don't think it makes a lot of sense for us because MPG was 31, Seren was only 26. We had just signed Seren to a long-term two-year contract with a two-year option in January, which we have traded for a guy who is out of contract at the end of the season and getting paid more. What is interesting, I think, and I know we're going to get to the other signings from today, is that we're starting to see how the off season is potentially going to go around MLS. And there's going to be a lot of moves. And I think Christ saw this in the short term to be able to make it to the playoffs, get that success that I'm sure the front office wants, fulfilling the stadium next year. Long term, it allows him to move out an expensive guy, taking up cap space and bringing some new talent from OCB and elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what happens with Perez Garcia in the post, you know, in the offseason, because here's a guy who, if Jason Christ does end up switching to a 4-4-2 with a diamond midfield, could play that Javier Morales role. Mm-hmm. He could play that top of that diamond and allow maybe Kaká to play a false nine up top with Larin. And he's a guy who is barely DP money. I mean, certainly the club has enough allocation money to pay that down and not have to worry about a DP slot. By the way, the DP slot is being eaten by San Jose for the rest of the year. So that's how come Perez Garcia can play for Orlando City, even though they have their three DP slots full. I'm still kind of a little scratching my head about how they let Rojas go out on loan and not get enough of his salary taken care of to get that DP slot open, or maybe they kept the recall ability. You know, we don't have all the details of that contract because MLS is
MLS.
About as it's about as transparent as a brick wall, really.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting pickup. I thought, you know, if he does go to 4-4-2, you don't need four or five potentially defensive midfielders when you have guys like, you know, Harrison Heath coming up behind already solid guys like Carrasco and Aguita. And, of course, Aguita may be moved in the offseason. We know there's interest. We don't know what's going to happen then. Nocerino is a guy who can play on the left side and has played on the left side in the diamond midfield and done quite well at it before. So it's a nice roster to have, and it's looking deeper all the time. Speaking of looking deeper, the club has acquired the MLS rights to Tony Rocha and also to Mikey Ambrose. Now, from Sporting Kansas City and FC Dallas, respectively, those players were drafted and property of those teams. They didn't sign contracts with them, so they could sign, you know, the USL contract with Orlando City, which they did, but their rights for MLS games and playing in MLS were owned by the original teams that drafted them. And Orlando City threw a couple of late draft picks in the next couple of drafts away to secure their rights and have promoted them and signed them to MLS contracts. And Tony Rocha certainly has earned that this year. He played quite a bit in the preseason with the first team. He played in the two U.S. Open Cup games and also played against Stoke City as the only reserve player to start with all MLS regulars. And the writing was always on the wall. I had the bold prediction before the season started that he would play in five MLS games for, you know, the Lions. And I was starting to get toward the end. And I was thinking, well, if you count the U.S. Open Cup games, there's only two senior team caps, but now a chance for him to get on the field regularly. And Mikey Ambrose really has been a bright spot for Orlando City B at left back, and that is a position of need now that we know that Jason Christ is not going to play Breck Shea as a defender. He's going to concentrate on going back to his attacking role and letting Breck be Breck and do the things that made him successful in FC Dallas. And Luke Bowden is probably not an everyday answer at left back, and you certainly needed to back up that position anyway. So Mikey Ambrose is a young guy. He's very mobile, and you know, unlike Bowden, he's got decent pace and also a pretty good handle on passing the ball. So it'll be interesting to see what these two young guys bring to the club.
Yeah, I think we've kind of seen it in OCB this season, and we obviously also saw it for Rocha in the Open Cup. I think this is about what owning your own farm team is about. I think it's an interesting timing that we've gone ahead and done this now. Obviously, we're heading towards the off season, and supposedly, I mean, we know Atlanta is coming in for next year. So does this mean we're going to have an expansion draft? I'm starting to lean to the fact that if we've decided to trade away some super draft picks to pick up these guys, are we going to burn through our 11 protected picks really that quickly? I'm beginning to think that maybe we're leaning towards we won't see an expansion draft this offseason, because otherwise I'm not too sure how these moves benefit the club for the future. Because they could just be easily picked up and away they go, and we've drafted and created talent for somebody else. I do like them, though, as solid picks, great depth picks. Obviously, we are looking very thin on the back line, so I think it makes a lot of sense for Ambrose to be able to come in there and give us that depth just in case somebody gets injured, because right now, if the Shea experiment is truly over, if Bowden goes down, there was nobody else that would be completely burned or picked apart by any even mediocre MLS offense. And then Ambrose, great talent for Rocha. I think we've seen it from him a lot. I think it was also the reason he came back from, was it Austin, I think, in the in the last, he was playing for Austin last year in USL and came back to us.
Yeah, both were actually.
Good talent. And then, of course, Austin isn't going to come back for the USL next season. So this also kind of started to make a bit more of a sense move too. I like it. I think it's great growth for this club at a young age.
Yeah, it absolutely did show the benefit of having the USL reserve side. And, you know, those guys were able to get, you know, training time with in front of the coaches, with these coaches. They were able to play against the first teamers. They were able to scrimmage against each other. And you could see, you know, which guys out there for these reserves have MLS-type talent. And they have been deemed, you know, ready to come in and give them an opportunity. And we'll see what happens. The expansion drafts typically happen in November if they happen. We're already into August. We've heard nothing about this. Which leads me to wonder, either why is MLS waiting, or you know, what are they going to do if there's not an MLS expansion draft? And I know that, you know, I guess the easy thing to do would be, if you do see a future for these guys with the club, is to maybe leave a more expensive player unprotected, like a Breck Shea, and then you know you deal with it if they take him. But you know, typically those high price tags will scare off a lot of expansion teams. So, you know, if there's an expansion draft, we'll see how they handle it. But I definitely think that Ambrose was coverage for Bowden, with Shea not being a pick for defense anymore. And Rocha was a guy who, you know, you can never have enough talented midfielders, and I think he's a guy who can spell a number of positions. He's very versatile, can play defensive or attacking midfield, and he's a guy who works really hard. He's got a high work rate, and tends to combine well with guys, and he's got a little bit of a feisty side too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's one thing that you expect from a Christ-driven side too. You expect young talent that he's going to be able to develop. That's what he did in RSL and was very successful with it. That's really what he tried to set up in New York City FC and just wasn't given the time. So I think these are going to be, I think they're going to be great pickups, and they really fit with what Christ has been brought in to do, which is develop talent, which is also why I think it is surprising that if we go back to the Seren Garcia for a minute, is the fact is we were led to believe that all of these players were being brought in to develop and then sell. We've kind of all of a sudden switched that tack by trading Seren for really very little, but then we go ahead and send two young guys potentially out of the system when we don't know what's going on. MLS is being MLS, and how it's really going to work in this offseason for protecting players or trading players, and whether or not MLS is just going to blow it up and start all over again.
Yeah, I mean, Major League Soccer is going to do whatever it's going to do. We're just going to sit back and watch, just like we saw with the Chicago, I think, is just perpetually going to own the number one allocation slot. They seem to have this figured out, where if we just stay where we're at, and then the second team will come along and want this player, and we could just get a bunch of stuff for them and take their allocation spot, we can perpetually stay in the number one spot and keep getting allocation money and draft picks and all that kind of thing. So, the rules are weird and dumb and not at all transparent. So where this will all shake out, who knows? But I definitely think that it was, if you're going to trade Seren, trade him to the Western Conference where you're not going to see him much. If he gets to play a lot, that's great. I mean, I know that Dominic Kinnear liked him, and, you know, he's a good player, but I think a lot of people, you know, some sentimental value there because he was with the USL Lions. But, you know, if you watched his play, he's, for everything that he does good, once he crosses the midfield line, his passes are not there. He can't link up on the offensive part of the field. It really hinders what you could do. He turns the ball over cheaply way too often. At his age, I don't think that's something he grows out of, really. So I don't think they gave up a ton, considering the depth at defensive midfield. And I think they potentially got a player who is dynamic enough to push them forward this year and possibly beyond. Who knows what's going to happen when his contract expires.
Yeah, and I think that's what you've traded for, is the potential asset for him to come in and say, you know what, you like it here, we'll keep paying you. You've got that dynamic ability. And once again, we don't know what this offseason looks like. Maybe somebody gets interested in Molino. He's starting to show it. He's getting that full season under his belt that we didn't get last year. Maybe we see a whole change and Molino gets shipped out. But I agree, Seren was one of five defensive midfielders, and he was low on the salary cap, but mistakes were getting made, and I think you could probably point to at least two or three games this season where he cost us the game with a bad challenge just outside of the box that was a blatantly obvious free kick and was converted. I think the Philadelphia game was like that, if I remember rightly, and I can't remember the other one that he was at fault for, but that's something that we can't give up anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he's lost his head a few times over the last couple of years. I remember just the team that he's being shipped to, he gave up a penalty in a completely unnecessary area of the box with the player running away from goal with the team having a lead. So he is prone to some lapses, but, obviously a good player, good locker room guy, good guy, just is part of the business, and we'll wish Darwin all the best of luck. Going to miss those haircuts for sure.
Yep.
So, before we get to our guest, obviously a couple of more teams from the club played this weekend. The Orlando Pride went to Boston and became only, I believe, the second victim of the Breakers all season and didn't score a goal. They lost 1-0. A very depleted Pride team with not only the internationals gone for the Olympics, but also Sarah Hagen was out with a concussion, and the team lost Leah Fortune, who retired in last week to take a job in the corporate world because women's soccer does not pay worth a damn.
Yep.
And, Tom Sormani took this patchwork club up there, and you'd think you might still be able to scratch out a goal or two against the Breakers, who have been pretty poor this year, but not a single goal. I think they had a goal waved off by Kaylin Kyle for an offside. But this doesn't appear to be the magical season for the Pride that it did a few weeks ago. And I always said that these few games, while the international stars were away, were going to be the difference. They decided not to make any moves in the window, and it really hurt them.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, just looking at their numbers, they are 6 wins, 9 losses, 0 ties, 15 games played. Obviously it's a 20 game season, and they're currently seventh. This stretch of games has just really hurt them beyond a doubt. And I think what they need to start moving into is building for next season and seeing who's going to be available. But even that's not a definite. Before this season ever started, a bunch of people retired that nobody was expecting. And then we had it ourselves this week with Leah Fortune, who saw, I'm going to guess, maybe 50 minutes for this team total. But that was a good solid depth player. She had played at an international level and she just kind of left. I think this club really saw that this week, and we couldn't beat the Breakers, and the Breakers have been the laughing stock of this league for quite some time because they just can't seem to get it right. And we didn't have any fight back for them. And I think having so many losses on our side compared to, with zero ties, I mean, that shows we're either scoring goals or conceding goals. We're not closing out games. We're not having the ability to do anything. So those final five games don't hold much hope, especially on the back of a really bad performance from against the Breakers. And even when the internationals come back, they're already going to be super tired. It's a grueling schedule if you go all the way to the gold medal game. Even when they come back, I'm not going to say that this team is all of a sudden going to go on a tear.
The good news is that Jose Boulanger didn't play in the first game, and the Australians look like maybe they'll be done early. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, it's not been good for the Pride, and it's with too many teams to jump over and only a short number of games to do it in. There's some winnable games there down the stretch, but it's a tall order. You're going to have to win the majority of those games, if not all of them, to get up into the top four. And the way that the teams have, like the Red Stars and the Thorns and the teams like that have played this year, I just don't think you're going to catch too many of them. And it's just, it's an expansion year. You can't expect too much, but it would be nice to finish strong and go into that off season with a little momentum and maybe, and make a few additions. The team is just a way too thin here this year in 2016. So go Pride, and we'll still root for you. But it's just not looking good for the rest of the season. Why don't we turn our attention to the USL real quickly? Orlando City B went up to Louisville City, and it looked like a game they were going to get blown out in. They gave up an early goal. Louisville City had a ton of possession, a ton of chances, and they were not able to convert on any. And then all of the sudden, in stoppage time, a penalty is given in the box, and Tyler Turner is the guy who steps up to take the penalty. He converts, and then in the final minute of stoppage time, they get a second from Keegan Smith and steal 3 points from USL leading Louisville City. A huge win, really, for the young Lions.
Oh, without a doubt, and like father, like son, if you want to class it in that kind of relationship. We'd seen Orlando kind of lose points last season, steal them this year, and then I think Orlando City they came out and gave that gritty performance that is required in USL. And if you go back to say that for the Orlando City New England game, you mentioned that they were leading in all of the stats categories that counted, and then they were able to turn it around. Louisville was leading. They should have been able to close out all that, and they weren't. And I think that shows great mental resolve. I think it shows you why we picked up two of OCB's players this week, is because we were able to go to a baseball stadium and win. First of all, that's quite an achievement for us as well.
That's new. Yeah.
And it was just a great, good, solid performance. And don't forget, Louisville was coached by James O'Connor, and they knew a lot about Heath's old system, but I think you're starting to see that change throughout the club, and that was really what happened in this game against Louisville.
Yeah, and let's not forget, OCB was a little shorthanded. Lewis Neal was out with an injury, and also, young Pierre Da Silva was off with the U.S. U19 team, and without two of their most experienced player and their most dynamic player, they go on the road. And again, some of their other starters weren't there because they've been backing up with the first team, guys like Donovan, and they go on the road to Louisville, which is a very, very difficult place to play, and they get the win. It's just an amazing turnaround for Anthony Pulis and his club, because at the beginning of the season they just looked lost, and they've really, really put together a solid season there. Eighth place and the final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference after that win, but a more solidified position with that. And, if they can get wins like that, and they're going to need to win on the road down the stretch to improve their playoff positioning and to ensure they get in. And now they're going to have to do it without Rocha and Ambrose, probably, for the most part. Only three home games left for the Orlando City B. So they're going to have a lot more performances like that.
Yeah, and of course, going away at the end of the season is always a difficult ask. But I think this side has matured. We're not asking that much from them. We're just, even if you scrape in an eighth place, you're still in the playoffs, which was the goal for this franchise. I think that if they can come through and do that, this team will be able to develop for next season and grow as a unit, because I think that's really what this team is all about. Away performances, though, good to be able to go to Louisville, because next time you go away from home, you can say, well, we won there. It was a short field. It was in a hostile environment, and we were able to bag it away with us. I think that's really great confidence heading down to the stretch. And there are still a lot of games to go, but hopefully it'll be good.
and some tough places to play like Cincinnati and that kind of thing. So go OCB, and what a performance by Mark Ridgers to keep his team in the game. It could have been so much more than 1-0 if not for the heroics of the Scotsman in net for Orlando City B. But anyway, we'll take it. Two victories for the club over the weekend, and of course the one loss for the Pride. You know, I think everybody had a nice time at the Stoke City, you know, friendly last week. It was a sellout over there in Titan Soccer Complex. Not a big place, obviously, but nice to see they sold it out. The stream was terrible because
so bad.
It was really bad. I'm told that it was a bandwidth issue because there were so many people watching it. A lot of Stoke City fans trying to watch it, a lot of Orlando City fans trying to watch it, and I think it was a problem with overloading the Wi-Fi at, or at least the internet over at Eastern Florida State College. That's what I've been told. That's not official. That's just something that has been buzzed into my ear, and I'm just passing that along. So take that, you know, with a grain of salt. But as we turn our attention to Sunday and a game against the Seattle Sounders, a team that beat Orlando City 4-0 last year at Century League Field when they were down to 10 men after 40 minutes because Tyler Turner lost his mind and got two yellow cards in a few minutes' time. We'll turn our attention to the Sounders, and we'll bring in our special guest to talk about that right after this. Joining us on the Mainland Podcast this week, we're happy to have Dave Clark from Sounder at Heart with us. Sounder at Heart, of course, the SB Nation blog covering the Seattle Sounders and probably the most viewed single team MLS blog anywhere, I'm guessing. But Dave, how you doing? And welcome to the show.
I'm having a good day. Thank you.
So the first thing I want to ask you about, Dave, is just in general, the craziness about Seattle this season. I mean, it started off early on, just before the season, with you know, Obafemi Martins leaving, and then you know, there's been obviously not the performances that you guys are used to, or that you expect, or that all of us expected, really. And you know, talk about the trouble in the locker room, and Clint Dempsey's not happy, And now you guys are in the middle of the window. You guys bring in a new player from Uruguay and a new DP, and it seems like almost like everything might be okay for you guys.
I don't know if it's okay yet. I mean, there's a lot of catching up to do, and a lot of stuff has happened. Excuse me. You know, the quick version is, whether local or national, everybody misjudged what Obafemi Martins contributed to the team. He made them. It was about more than just his own goals and assist numbers, but the team was just better. It functioned, and they didn't replace him, and it no longer functioned, which meant that Clint Dempsey fell off the planet as an effective goal scorer. He's only got 3 goals this year. So where people had thought, yeah, the Sounders go from an MLS Cup contender to, they'll at least make the playoffs. They still have Clint Dempsey to this terrible season where they look like one of the worst teams in the league. They, for the most part, have had a solid defense that doesn't really get broken down. It just counts on them making mental errors. So the defense, for the most part, is solid. The offense has plummeted. President of soccer, Garth Lagerwey, didn't do much to replace Obafemi Martins until signing Nicolas Lubero, but that's the Uruguayan that's mentioned. But that was announced the day after they announced that Siggy Schmidt was no longer the coach. So it's been a weird year of transition here. Seattle Sounders fans aren't really used to not having a playoff caliber team, and we're trying to figure out what that means now.
Well, and, you know, the one player I think you guys really had set your sights on at the start of the season who eventually signed with you was Jordan Morris. I think people expected him to kind of be the very young replacement for Obafemi Martins, but it really hasn't worked out for him. Do you see him being able to grow into that role, or do you think it's going to take a bit of a restructuring to make something happen?
Well, I mean, if people wanted him to be at an Obafemi Martins replacement level, they're foolish. Kyle Larin wasn't at Obafemi Martins replacement level, and he's the best rookie attacking player in the history of the league. The fact is, Jordan Morris has more goals than all but two rookies in the history of MLS. Considering that a failure has more to do with people's expectations than it does with Jordan Morris's performance. He's finishing goals at a rate that's very typical for an MLS striker. Now, Obafemi Martins finished at a rate that was atypical. the main reason people think Jordan Morris isn't doing well is because they place expectations upon him that were unfair. And in some ways, I think a lack of understanding of what American soccer is. I mean, Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey had 7 goals in the rookie season. Jordan Morris had 7 goals.
Yeah, that's when you talk about it like that, it puts it all into perspective. We're a little spoiled here with what Kyle Larin was able to put together last year, and I think that I know I heard national guys early this season saying Jordan Morris is going to break Kyle Larin's record this year. So, I mean, there was obviously a lot of expectation and a lot of pressure put on him early on.
It's been a couple of weeks, but like 2 weeks ago, Jordan Morris moved past Kyle Larin work when it was day neutral. Jordan Morris's 7th goal happened when basically the same number of games into the season that Kyle had 6. Mm-hmm. So, Kyle not only had a great season, he also had a great 2 months, basically, if I remember correctly, August and September, where he scored as many goals in those 2 months as other rookies do in their entire opening year.
Yeah, it definitely helped that he scored hat tricks against both New York teams. that'll add up your totals in a hurry. 6 goals against two games, but. I want to talk to you a little bit about Siggy Schmidt because, you know, obviously Orlando City also parting ways with a head coach this year and, a popular head coach. And I wondered kind of how Seattle fans were, how they were taking that and how they view it because, you know, it is a down year, but Siggy Schmidt is a commodity it's pretty known throughout the league. And I just wanted to kind of get your feeling on where Seattle fans are with the move and what you think is maybe next for Siggy.
Seattle fans fit into a couple different buckets with the move. Well, there have been people campaigning for Siggy to be fired literally after he won the Supporters' Shield but didn't make the MLS Cup. People said he should be fired for that. it's a vocal element, but the standard here is so high that basically, if you don't win an MLS Cup, you can't do better than what Siggy Schmidt did. He had a 20-win season in the post-shootout era, one of only 3 teams to do that. Won a Supporters' Shield, won the 3 straight, and then the additional Open Cup, making the final for a 5th. Was only the second MLS coach to beat a team in Mexico. Advanced over a Mexican team in the CONCACAF Champions League knockout rounds. The list of accolades that he racked up here created a standard that was impossible to maintain. On top of that, you have this horrible season. You have what seems to be Garth Lagerwey said that he deferred about some of the signings, indicating that he signed players that he didn't necessarily think were great, but that other people within the talent evaluation staff did. Mm-hmm. You get into that, but that to me sounds like there's some back office politicking going on. And from that, if Garth says that Siggy's not going to be here in 2017, and I think everybody felt that way at this point, on a bad year, it's time to make the change. And they called it a mutual separation or whatever. I actually think that they were truthful in that because I think what Siggy Schmidt gave his assistants, and particularly Brian Schmetzer, the opportunity to earn jobs for 2017 and beyond. If you go through an off-season house cleaning, the assistant coaches are likely gone as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, you mentioned all of those accolades for Siggy without taking it all the way, and but you go, you did get Garth Lagerwey, who was considered one of the best GMs from RSL a few years back. Do you think that is ultimately what put him under the pressure to kind of make that separation? Only head coach you've ever known, but you can't get over that hump, even though you supposedly have a great GM.
Yeah, and I think part of it is those are two really powerful personalities within the American soccer sphere, and getting them to work together is just hard. Managing that level of personality. You see it in American sports all the time. You know, famous coach and famous GM. Unless they started with the organization together, things tend to sour. And I think there was a little bit of that. Now, everything that I've heard is that they're very friendly to each other, but it was really about philosophies around soccer and the ideal way it should be played and how to manage that as an organization that, you know, is structured from U12 all the way to a first team with a large budget. So to me, it's that. And when Adrian Anauer stepped aside from the soccer side of the house and brought in Garth Lagerwey, this was one of the things that was likely to happen. And I'm betting that Adrian was hoping that the split would happen after an MLS Cup was won, because ages ago he entrusted Siggy Smith to run the organization, essentially.
Yeah.
Dave, let's turn our attention a little bit toward this weekend. You guys just brought in, as we mentioned, Nicolas Ladero as a DP, and from all intents and purposes, I didn't get a chance yet to watch the game, but for all intents and purposes, from what I've heard, a very good performance in his debut against the LA Galaxy, and the team seemed a little refreshed and renewed. Obviously, you got to be cautiously optimistic. There's always a bump when you get, you know, something new happening with the team. You know, what did you see from this guy, and what does he sort of bring to the Sounders that was missing?
Well, I'm going to borrow a joke from one of our commenters, but basically MLS Soccer put together a great all-touches video for you. It's the entire match. He had 124 touches, third highest in the year in Major League Soccer. That's on a team he'd never played on artificial surface before, so this was his first exposure to an artificial surface. He had practiced at CenturyLink, I believe. Or no, they didn't practice at CenturyLink that week. So that was his first game in practice on an artificial surface. He's had two full days of practice with his new teammates, and that's it. And it's an 18-hour flight from Buenos Aires to Seattle. That's the fastest that you can do that journey. And he did that Monday and Tuesday. So he put forward that kind of performance with a team that was dispirited, that had a new coach in place. And that's basically as many strikes against you as you can have. It's a 27-year-old Uruguayan number 10 that was the attacking mid for Boca Juniors. It's a great signing, and all of the potential was demonstrated when he played on the field. If he'd gotten an assist or a goal, it would have been a storybook kind of performance. Instead, it was merely just a great one.
Yeah, and obviously you guys are making another long trip, you know, West Coast to East Coast. The teams at the bottom of you with the Western Conference haven't really traveled very well away from home. Do you think you might be able to turn that tide around and start clawing towards the red line?
At this point, the Sounders just can't think about a red line. They have to think about every match. If they want to make the playoffs, it's got to be about getting 3 points this weekend. And worry about next weekend, and watch the standings never. The only way they're going to make a run is if they do it themselves. A draw against the LA Galaxy at home wasn't an ideal result. So they're back to pretty much against the wall. even the most optimistic Sounders fan, of which I'm probably the leader of that group, doesn't think they're making the playoffs. They do have games in hand over most of the teams in front of them. They have Lithero. Clint Dempsey's not going to miss any more games, really, for national team duty. They also signed Uruguayan Alvaro Fernandez, who spent parts of three seasons, but basically two seasons here, scored 18 total all-competition goals. So that'll help the offense. Morris continues to be able to be the leading scoring threat on the team. So there's a potential that the team rights itself. But really, this is about figuring out how to play Clint Dempsey and Nicholas Lithero together, how Jordan Morris can be up top in front of both of them. And that's the foundation for 2017. That should be a good attacking core. And how do you put parts around that? How does Ozzie Alonso fit behind them? Christian Roldan, maybe an Eric Freebird. What are the center backs? Ramon Torres, who is the Panamanian giant, who tore his ACL last year. He'll be returning shortly. So, but, you know, focusing on Orlando, I don't think Sounders fans expect to win. What they want to see is they want to see Clint and Nico play well.
Well, why don't we turn our attention to that that game specifically and how you see it? And before we let you go, we obviously always want to get your thoughts on what the key matchup this weekend will be, and how do you see the final score sort of shaping up?
Yeah, for me, the key matchup, and it's interesting, mainly because Clint and Nico use similar spaces, and you guys with the two defensive midfielders at the same time. In that 4-2-3-1, Clint's going to drop into the space where the defensive mids have to pick him up. That's the same spot where Lithero likes to play as well. So those two against Servando Carrasco and I think the other partner is a little bit in question. I know last week it was Nacarino, who I was kind of surprised to see start.
Well, guess what? Chris Nigueira got suspended, so it's probably going to be no Chirino again this week.
Okay. So, yeah, playing in that gap between those two and the center backs, that's where Nico and Clint have to do their damage. And kind of on the other side, it's Ozzy and Roldan trying to control Kaká. And I'm frightened about that. That man can see through balls that nobody else can. So he'll be picking out Kyle, and I'm normally confident in this defense, but I expect two goals against just because how good Kaká is and what he can do to control a game from those spaces.
So how do you see the final score shaping up?
I expect probably just a goal from the Sounders. I'd like to see two. I think Orlando's defense is a little bit soft at times, and they should be able to perform well. But again, it's another turf game. Nico's still adjusting to that. And it's that kind of travel that for Lithero meant continental competition. In MLS, it just means league play. So it's as far as the Sounders can go within the league, and one of the longest trips out there. So that's going to be an impact. It's a road game. The Sounders are poor on the road this year. So I guess what I'm predicting is 2-1 for the Lions.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. We're certainly not going to make it easy for you with the weather. It's going to be hot and humid. And that's never easy on a team that's traveling. I do want to ask a bonus question, though, before we let you go, too. Obviously, in the midweek, we shipped Darwin Serén off to San Jose Earthquakes for Matias Perez-Garcia, someone that you're probably pretty well acquainted with following a team in the Western Conference. What is Orlando City getting in the 5-5 Perez-Garcia?
He's a guy that I was kind of hoping that the Sounders would look into a DP swap. Nelson Hato Valdez up here has been underperforming. He has four goals in all competitions. To be clear, there are only four competitions. He just won in each of them. Now he's been here a year. That's not good for a $1.4 million designated player. So I would have loved to have seen them swap out. To me, MPG, Perez Garcia, he was underperforming. Some of that was fit. He's a guy that I think is great with the ball. He's got a good vision. He does, unlike Lothario, who's basically the same height, Perez Garcia plays small, gets knocked off the ball fairly easy. He might be better in wide spaces than he is centrally, but he's the type that can provide a secondary source of assist besides Kaká. I know watching Orlando, if you can control Kaká, then you can control the offense. And by providing another strong ball handler and passer to work alongside him, I think that's a good option. And plus, you didn't need to take a DP slot. It's a complete flyer, and it's the type of move that I think is good for the organization because it gives them a chance to look at what they've got, bringing in a new player and a new coach at the same time can kind of rejuvenate a team. So to me, it looks like a good move, mainly because it hardly costs you.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thanks so much. If this makes you feel any better, Valdez's MLS goal was against us last year.
Oh, I forgot that. That's a good note. maybe he just needs to play Orlando all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. It's some guys have it for certain teams. I know Kyle Larin tears up the New York teams left and right, but he's starting to do that to everybody. But Dave Clark, Sounder at Heart, thanks so much. We appreciate you coming on. You're a very knowledgeable guy. You're one of the really strong voices with SB Nation MLS blogs, and we really appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate you guys having me on the podcast. I love what you do, and I hope for Orlando's sake that you get a playoff appearance, because I know that city, Michael and I have chatted about this. I've got family that lives out in Orlando, and I know that city has embraced that team on par with the, well, better than a Salt Lake, on par with Portland, that kind of lower market size has really embraced MLS in ways that some of the larger markets haven't. So I'd love to see you guys get the fan base there, get rewarded with the play on the field matching the atmosphere and the business success.
Well, thanks so much, Dave, and we hope to have you on again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Well, that will just about do it for episode 60 of the Mainland Podcast. Before we get out of here, though, obviously, we have a few more items of business to get to, and we obviously want to thank Dave Clark from Sounder at Heart for stopping by this weekend and giving us the lowdown on the Sounders, this weekend's opponents. Dave's a really just a class guy. He knows his stuff and very knowledgeable about the league and very passionate about his team and really a good guest. He had some great answers for us.
Yeah, he really did. He's very knowledgeable, and I think that he brought a lot to it. And I think this Sunday will be a really interesting game.
I do too. I really have no real read on this game. It's going to be very difficult. I don't even know what my prediction is going to be until we get into it. But we'll get to that in a minute. One thing I did want to mention: the Pride is off now until the end of the month of August. They will play Washington on the 26th, and it's hard to imagine all of the internationals will be playing in that game, especially the U.S. players who might go fairly deep into the Olympic tournament. So there's a few weeks without a Pride game, and they only have a few games left. OCB's season is going to start to wind down soon, and another item for the Pride: two Pride goal scorers on opening day of Olympic action, with Alex Morgan scoring the insurance goal for the U.S. in the first minute of the second half. And Monica from Brazil, the hosts, she got her team on the board in a 3-0 win over China.
Yeah, once again, great performances. I think that, obviously, I think everybody expects the U.S. to go on and win it. That doesn't isn't going to help the Pride in any way, shape, or form. We need those bodies back. And let's be honest, I think, you know, if the men's team wants to win it for in their home stadium, I can't believe that the women don't too. And they've still got Marta, who's playing in her fifth, and I think Formiga is in her sixth Olympics. So they've got some really great talent. So look out for them both, and hope, you know, maybe we'll see the Australians back beforehand.
We'll see. Brazil, Canada is obviously a team to watch, and France, and those teams are all going to be challenging. And, you know, obviously we want the U.S. to win, but it obviously it's also going to keep Alex Morgan away from us longer. So it's a double-edged sword. All right, so let's turn our attention to Sunday. We've got to, we've got the team in green coming in. Seattle Sounders making the cross continental trip there, transcontinental trip from the Pacific Northwest all the way down here to Central Florida. How do you see this game shaping up in terms of what is your key matchup and what's your prediction for Sunday?
I am going to echo Dave very closely. I think it's the new guy, Ladero. He had such a great performance that you don't want to underestimate him having a bit of a sophomore slump second game. Obviously, it's a long trip, but I think we still have a potential rotating partnership of defensive midfielders. Obviously, Higuita is suspended, so it is likely to be the same partnership of Carrasco and Higuita. Carrasco and Nocerino. But I think they're really going to have to work hard to keep him quiet, because Dempsey is still on the field, not having a great season, but still very dangerous. You then also have Jordan Morris, who is still a great player, and will be looking to break his slump at some point. And we have a very shaky defense, so I think it's going to be defensive midfielders keeping Ladero quiet, shutting down that service to Dempsey and Morris up front. I'm also going to echo his scoreline. I think we get two, but we are porous enough to at least concede one. My scorers for all sides, I think Morris actually does score for Seattle. And then I think Molino continues his great July into August. And I'm going to say Shea also gets one as well.
Wow, that'd be cool. See Breck Shea get a goal from his maybe right wing position.
Maybes. I think he's potentially rejuvenated by getting the fact that he's going to be able to shake off that left back designation. And I think he'll be wanting to show that he can be the player that we all thought he was going to be coming in, and when he was at Dallas and Stoke, and that player moving forward.
I'd like to see a golazo from him from like way outside the box, just absolutely torch one past Stefan Fry. That'd be really good.
Yeah.
Great to see. He certainly got the leg for it. He could do it. Interesting. I don't know how to read this game. It's really, I mean, the Sounders on paper, and when you look at the scores, and when you look at when I've seen their games and when I've seen their highlights, they look like a bad team. But you look at the names and you look down the roster and you say, this is a very good team. This is a very good team full of good players.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I'm going to say my key matchup is, can Kyle Larin combat Chad Marshall and Brad Evans? They got, Dave said, they've got a good defense. They've got good defenders on that back line. And Kyle Larin against Chad Marshall especially is going to be a very interesting matchup for me. And, throw Brad Evans in, because, you know, when has Kyle Larin only had one defender on him, you know, this year? I don't think it's happened. That's going to be a big matchup. And obviously I think Kaká against Osvaldo is going to be, you know, another big matchup there in the middle of the park. Those are the two key matchups I see. If Seattle's good on set pieces, that could really spoil things for the home side, because, you know, I don't have to tell you that the team has been very shaky defending those set pieces this year. And with guys that can take them like Dempsey, and then guys who can play on the other end of them like Morris, and even, you know, you mentioned Valdez. I know Dave doesn't like Valdez, but he did score against us last year. You know, they've got guys who can get on the end of those, and even their defenders, like guys like Marshall and Evans, can get on those aerial balls. So I'm scared to death of set pieces, and I'm as a result of that, I'm going to predict a 2-2 draw. Ooh. Which I think is not what this team needs. They need 3 points, but it's hard for me to see past all of that talent, even though they haven't been a great team this year. If they continue to build on what they did against the Galaxy, it will be tough for Orlando. Now, I do think that Orlando needs to get on them early because of the travel and the heat. I think that could be a big ally to the Lions if they can get an early couple of goals. It will be much tougher for Seattle to come from behind than it would for Orlando, is what I'm saying, I guess.
Yeah.
So, anyway, those are our predictions, and don't wager on anything we say, because I think last week I predicted a 1-1 draw, and it was 3-1 to Orlando.
Yeah, I think I predicted a 2-2 draw, so, you know, I think I went with the status quo, but
yeah,
it turned out to be a much better. We were still living under the fear of the previous games, though, I think, and this time where I'm a little bit more positive that we can continue to frustrate Seattle in what has been a very frustrating season for them.
Well, I hope so. I hope that's the case. I want to see it happen twice before I kind of climb on board a little bit. You know, I think anybody could do it once, but doing it twice would be hard. But yeah, it'll be great to get 3 points and certainly continue the team's pretty good record against the Western Conference. You got to get them when they're here. And you know, the home games are running thin for the rest of this season. So when the teams come in here, you need to get 3 because Orlando City's still just one victory on the road this year.
Yeah, and obviously, like you say, we've kind of burned through a lot of our home games. So if we can keep pace, we have to be able to win those away games. And hopefully a defensive marshalling system that Christ can potentially instill will make all the difference. But time is running out. It's already August. The gap is starting to get a little bit further away for those teams that are pulling away. And our game differential is changing all the time as well.
Yeah. And, you know, we got some midweek games coming up. So the schedule is going to get more compact here in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The team will play Seattle on Sunday. Then they are off for a week, and then they go to Chicago on the 14th, and then at Colorado. So that's going to be a tough trip because Colorado has been very good this year, especially defensively, although you wouldn't know it from watching that New York City game the other day. And then, immediately after Colorado on Saturday the 20th, they come back on the 24th home against Toronto in a midweek game, and then New York City comes in on the 28th. So a lot of games left in August, some good opponents when you're talking about Toronto, New York City, and Colorado, very good opponents coming up. And so you got to get your points where you can get them. And, a team that has struggled is making the longest trip in MLS pretty much is a team you need to jump on. And hopefully Jason Christ's team can do that. I don't think they can get away with an okay first half like they had last week. I think they need a good first half.
Yeah, agreed. So, I think they have to, like you say, they have to come out and show Seattle that they're not going to be a walkover, that they're not going to be the same team that they saw up in the Pacific Northwest last year where we got a little bit frustrated and then just completely fell apart. We can't be that team this year. We need to be able to take 3 points and from a team that's struggling, because if we can't beat a team that's struggling, how do we ever expect to stay in touch with everybody else?
Yeah. If we can't beat a team that's struggling, we are the team that's struggling.
Yeah, there you go. On a bumper sticker.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see how it all plays out on Sunday. And, of course, we'll be back next week to talk about it and break down all the action and, hopefully we'll be talking about another win, but, we won't know until the game is played. And then, of course, Orlando City B is in action on Saturday night. They're home against Toronto FC2. So we'll have a little bit of breakdown on that as well. And then we'll probably talk a little bit about the Pride players that are in the Olympics. So we'll have plenty to talk about again next week. But if you want to talk to us and ask us anything, please send us an email, themainland@gmail.com. And Maine is spelled like a lion's mane, M-A-N-E, not M-A-I-N. So themainland@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter, @themainland, same spelling, and ask us anything. And just put a little hashtag in there. Ask TMLPC. It's the Mainland Podcast. It's the initials there. A little acronym. Okay, so that'll do it for episode number 60. Please visit us at themainland.com. Of course, on Twitter, as we just mentioned, @themainland. Like us on Facebook. And, you know, please give us a nice rating on iTunes and a little bit of a review would be good. That's how we get to the top of those charts. When people do their searches, they search and then they're going to get the ones that are getting all the good pub first. So help us out a little bit if you will. Doesn't cost you anything. And we'll see you next week with an all new edition of the Mainland Podcast. For Andrew Harrison, I am Michael Citro of the Mainland saying, go City.